Welcome to Inside the Road, a podcast where we speak to the leading minds in wealth management. I'm your host, David Clark, and in this episode, I'm really happy to bring you my discussion with Armin Panossian, the co-CEO and head of performing credit at the famed Oak Tree asset management firm, the firm that's so well known for its management of distressed debt, where they've been averaging returns a little north of mid-teens number, so outstanding returns at what they would argue are significantly less volatility or risk than in equity markets. During our conversation, we talked to Armin about the asset class and the general characteristics of it, as well as some of the opportunities and threats he sees in the current market and moving forward. Please remember, this advice is not designed, nor is it specific financial advice or any advice of any type. People are encouraged, of course, to seek any advice before making any potential investments and reading all disclosure documents and listening to the disclaimer at the back of this podcast. Please do, however, keep your emails coming. You can email me at david.clark@codacapital.com. The feedback and the suggestions for future episodes is greatly valued. Enjoy the episode. Armin Panossian, welcome to Inside the Rope.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here, David.
Thanks for joining us from, I think you're in LA at the moment. We've dealt with the time difference. Perhaps you could start off by giving our listeners an introduction to yourself and who you are.
Great. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to join you today and with your listeners. I am Armin Panossian. I am the co-chief executive officer of Oak Tree Capital Management. I've been at the firm for 17 years, but before I get into my history at Oak Tree, I am the proud father of four. I've been married since 2005. Grew up in Los Angeles, came back to Los Angeles after graduate school, and spend my weekends driving my kids around to water polo and basketball and baseball games. So that's kind of probably what I'm best known for in the house. But outside of the house at Oak Tree, I am the co-chief executive officer, been at the firm, as I said, 17 years. When I joined the firm 17 years ago, it was in what we call our opportunistic credit group, which is what we call our distressed debt strategy. I was part of that team during the global financial crisis. And then later on, held a variety of different roles at the firm before becoming co-chief executive officer. My history is after growing up in Los Angeles, I attended Stanford University, graduated in 1998, moved to New York and worked on Wall Street for 2 years as an investment banker, mergers and acquisitions, a banker at Morgan Stanley in the late 90s, and then went back to graduate school where I got both a law degree and a business degree from Harvard, and decided at that point that I really wanted to spend most of my career in distressed debt, opportunistic credit investing, some private equity as well. Soon after graduating in 2004 with a JD and MBA, I joined Oak Tree in 2007 and have been here ever since.
So, Armin, you must have some proud parents with a resume like that, Stanford, Harvard Law, and Harvard Business School. They don't seem to get scripted any better. Congratulations. Perhaps you can give us a bit of a background for people not familiar with Oak Tree as to who Oak Tree is and or what it is and what it does and what it's known for in markets.
Absolutely. Oak Tree was founded in 1995. The founders began working together in 1985, managing high yield bond funds and convertibles funds. Howard Marks, one of our co-founders, some of your listeners might have read his letters, was a pioneer in high yield bond investing, beginning at Citibank in the late 1970s, went to the Trust Company of the West in the 80s, and worked with his future partners at Oak Tree beginning in 1985. In 1987, they were joined by Bruce Karsh, who started one of the world's first institutional asset management strategies in distressed debt at TCW. And they all kind of left TCW in 1995 to start Oak Tree. It is a credit-first manager in terms of its DNA, in terms of its investment philosophy. We have a six-point investment philosophy that Howard Marks drafted when he started Oaktree. And the first, and I would say the most important rule, is called the primacy of risk control. In other words, as a credit investor, especially if you do your job right, you get your interest coupons when they're due and then your money back. And so how good a job you do is really predicated on how good of a job you do avoiding bad outcomes. How do you defend your client's capital and avoid losses? And that's really what a credit mindset is all about. At Oaktree, we don't really talk about the upside because most of what we do is credit oriented, and it's more about protecting against the downside. Our largest single strategy at the firm is our opportunistic credit strategy. It's over 20% of our 190 billion of assets under management is in opportunistic credit of a variety of types. We also manage a considerable amount of capital in performing credit of a variety of types, including our legacy areas of high yield bonds and convertibles. On top of that, we have broadly syndicated loans and private debt, real estate debt, and other areas. We are, again, a large alternative investment manager. And although we have strategies outside of credit, credit is most of what we do, and really informs how we make our decisions, even outside of credit. You know, we have an emerging market equities strategy, but even there, we are always focused on downside protection and very much a credit mindset in protecting client capital rather than more of a glass half full type of investment mantra.
And Armin, I noticed your title, and also you've touched on it there a little bit, including the conversation of performing credit. Would you, for the benefit of the listeners, maybe just drill into the delineation between performing and non-performing credit or debt?
Yeah, performing credit means that it's a healthy borrower. And it typically means that when you lend to such a healthy borrower, you're lending at or near par, or at or near 100 cent dollars. So if they're borrowing $100 million, you're lending them roughly pretty close to $100 million, and they owe you, and you expect to get $100 million back, plus the interest coupons. Opportunistic credit also can include distressed debt, where your purchase price may be at a very steep discount to par, or you may be originating debt that is to a borrower where you actually expect the borrower to have a meaningful risk of default, but you have structured your particular instrument in a way that it would be protected. In other words, while the borrower may not necessarily be performing, your opportunistic loan to that borrower is expected to recover. Now, that would be, we would throw that in our opportunistic side of our house rather than our performing side, because generally speaking, clients that invest in performing companies or performing credit expect for their managers to just avoid defaults and avoid any sort of potential risk of disruption of interest income. And so that's how we kind of delineate it. Do we actually think this borrower may possibly have an interruption in its cash flow such that our expectation around receiving such cash flow could be at risk?
So would that be categorized far more, including strategies where you're loaning to own on, and the risk profile is becoming much closer to equity than a performing high grade credit?
Yes. In opportunistic credit, I would say the targeted returns are equity-like. Mm-hmm. We would say the targeted risk profile is less risky than equity, but it's somewhere in between equity on the one hand and plain vanilla, healthy borrowers borrowing money on the other hand.
Okay. And you opened the door there around sort of return profiles and expectations. So what has Oaktree's track record been? And out of these various investment asset classes that you invest in or across, I kind of think of equity like at one end and, you know, high grade government bond at the other end. What's the sort of diversion or the different return profiles you'd expect roughly? So firstly, what's Oaktree's past performance been typically in these classes, and then what should people expect going forward and now?
Yeah, I'll try to stay pretty general about it because we don't want to get in trouble with the SEC
or anyone else. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, so the way I would separate it is on our performing credit side of the house, And a lot of that is liquid or tradable credit, like high yield bonds or broadly syndicated loans, where there's an observable benchmark. Our performance in those types of tradable credit tend to be similar to the benchmark through a long period of time or through a cycle, but typically with less volatility. We typically have fewer defaults and fewer losses than the benchmark does, but we put up similar or slightly better returns over a long period of time. So, you know, lower volatility through that cycle. And the way we do that is we, especially when the market is weak, when there's an economic recession occurring, we do a really good job of avoiding those bad outcomes, those defaults. So when the market has a deep dive, we tend to, you know, meaningfully outperform. When the when the market is doing quite well, we tend to do a fairly good job of keeping up with that, you know, strength in the market. So that type of pattern of performance leads to a lower volatility and benchmark-like or slightly better than benchmark-like outcome. In our opportunistic credit strategies, you know, generally speaking, we're targeting mid-teens returns, and I would say over the very long term, we've generally been in that area. I probably don't want to get any more specific than that.
Sure.
Yeah, but it is meant to be, and a lot of our clients, they do view opportunistic credit either in their private equity bucket or in a specific bucket that they would call special situations or private credit, if they wanted to kind of zoom out a little bit. Special situations is often within private credit for a lot of clients or institutional clients. And then special situations is kind of a little bit of a specific area within private credit. But a lot of our large institutions, it's one or the other. They either view it as a comparable to private equity because the return profile is generally similar, and the lockup on our vehicles tends to be similar to private equity. But we try to manage the risk a little bit lower than what you would typically see in private equity.
So talk to me a little bit about, you touched on there, and I'll get you to expand on the illiquidity that most of your investors face. I'd be keen to hear from you in terms of the volatility that your clients experience. And are these assets typically marked to market, or are they things that are revalued less often, giving the client a smoother ride?
It's a great question. So it depends on the strategy. In opportunistic credit, there are both private assets, which are marked to their fundamental performance of the companies rather than a observable market price. But there are also publicly traded instruments in those portfolios. So it is indeed a mix. And the ratio of that mix depends on what is happening in the markets and the economy. For example, in the current with the current market backdrop, I would say that the markets are actually functioning better than expected, and the price of the publicly traded bond market is at a fairly tight spread to the relevant treasury bond yield. And as a result of that, there isn't a lot of publicly traded distressed debt that we would expect to buy in our opportunistic credit portfolios at the current time. We would have some, but not 100% of the portfolio. We would expect, however, that we would originate private capital solutions to borrowers who need some sort of lifeline, and because they might have too much debt, and therefore they need some sort of hybrid equity debt-like instrument that only an Oaktree or a very large manager that like us, which there are very few and far between, that could do it. They would need that type of capital solution, which typically comes in a private context. And the way, generally speaking, such private instruments are marked is based on the fundamental performance of the business relative to expectations, not if the markets generally sell off or generally move up. But if the company underperforms, then typically you would see a markdown of that private asset base. So they will, usually private assets, both performing private assets and opportunistic private assets, would have a stickier profile around their marks, and therefore a more consistent observation around the income component of the return and more stability.
And how are you seeing things at the moment? I suspect that you're a manager that quite likes it when things get a bit rough and tumble, and you look back in history, you know, some of those economic tough periods have been great opportunities for you. And it feels like, you know, the narrow glide path of a soft landing would seem to have been achieved, and we'll see later this year. What are you seeing at the moment as both the opportunities and the risks?
There's, I agree with the preamble to your question. It appears that there is a glide path that is a soft landing or no landing scenario. And that's good for the world. That's good for the economy. And while Oaktree, or at least Oaktree's opportunistic credit activities may need to adjust to that type of scenario, the reality is that the markets are so big now. The credit markets have tripled, and in some cases quadrupled, if you include private credit or the growth in investment grade credit. They're so big now that the tails around those markets, where the portion of those markets where issuers are underperforming, they've gotten so thick that the dollar value of that stress, even against the backdrop of an otherwise healthy market or an otherwise healthy economy, is so big that the amount of dollars needed to solve those problems is still quite considerable. So even if there isn't a recession, there is a tremendous need for capital to come in the form of capital solutions to solve capital structures that were put in place in 2018, 2019, or 2021, when base rates were not expected to be this high. Nobody doing an LBO in 2019 thought that we would see 5% SOFR. SOFR at that time was 25 basis points. And so some of those capital structures have been able to glide through, and the businesses have grown and done well through COVID and through the inflationary aftermath of COVID. And so that's great for those borrowers, but that is not a uniform outcome. And there are a significant number of borrowers that, unfortunately for them, have not grown into their capital structure. They will default or will need a capital solution to avoid a default. And so we find ourselves in a fortunate situation as an opportunistic credit manager, or at least that of that part of our business, that we are able to originate private solutions of size and with very attractive borrowers, very large borrowers globally, who need that type of solution just because they took on too much debt at a time when the debt was really, really cheap. And these businesses are actually good businesses, businesses that you and I would love to own, but they just have bad balance sheets. And that's the ideal scenario for an opportunistic credit investor. You really want to lend or invest in a company that's a great business, but with a bad balance sheet. So we're really excited about that opportunity. Now, if you and I are wrong and there is a shock and a recession actually turns the corner, well, then I think the opportunity is massive in the opportunistic credit investment area, and we will have some major issues as in the global economy, just because I think the value of the securities that would need to trade would just be tremendous, and so. That's not what we're banking on. That's not what we're building up our treasure chest for, to be honest with you. Frankly, if there's a recession, Oaktree could have multiples of the capital and dry powder that we actually do have and still deploy it. But we've really built up our capabilities, our dry powder, in anticipation of a more modest or mild recession. Or even no recession, but still the need for that capital solution. I don't want to talk too long, but one thing on this point, the reason we actually think that the likely scenario is what I described, that even without a recession, there's these problems, is because, one, inflation is a little bit stickier than people thought. So the inflationary numbers do not support a meaningful rate reduction this year. There will probably be some rate reduction by the Fed, but hard to see why it would be 150 basis points, unless there's a shock and a recession and something that we didn't anticipate. So if rates do stay high because inflation's a little bit high and the economy is not really rolling over, it's sort of, you know, in this Goldilocks scenario of between, you know, 0 and 2% growth, the Fed doesn't really have a reason to reduce rates to stimulate the economy. It'll just kind of steady as she goes. Why really do anything? So rates stay higher for an extended period of time. And those borrowers that took on leverage in anticipation of SOFR remaining at 25 basis points forever, or in anticipation of meaningful growth that they would grow into their capital structures as a result, they will experience, you know, defaults and stress and losses, et cetera. So that's why we actually think, our base case is that there isn't a huge recession, a big problem, but that rates do stay higher as a result of there not being a recession. And therefore, there will be an elevated default experience, an elevated loss experience, and a need for capital solutions that are mainly private in nature.
And are there any sectors that you think that's going to be more pronounced in?
I think that where we're seeing the greatest cracks at the moment, which these are early indicators of cracks. One, real estate in the U.S. And two, I would say healthcare would be the other. Healthcare services in particular. So let's talk about real estate first. Mm. Real estate, generally it has been financed by insurance companies, banks, and securitizations. If you look at the maturity schedule for real estate assets that have been financed, the maturity schedule is upon us right here, right now. This is not a problem that we will face in 3 years and we'll just see where we are. The maturity is happening now, and it's consistent next year and the year after. And so as assets that were financed when rates were very, very low come up for refinancing, and if they have not had meaningful rental growth to justify what is now the new rate environment, then equity capital is needed to delever that capital structure and extend the loan. Borrowers are not uniform in their access to capital. And the other thing is, some of these assets, especially in the commercial office category, they have a lot of vacancies too, because, you know, after COVID, there was a work from there, you know, where the work from home environment has continued to some extent. And so not as much office space is needed to operate businesses. And so there's a lot of vacancy. There are many gateway markets that have big vacancies. And if you're the owner of an office building that's 20 or 30% vacant, and you look at the few million dollars that you need to re-tenant the building because tenant improvements are necessary, but you're underwater on your mortgage and it's coming due in 6 or 12 months, you're not going to spend the $3-5 million to re-tenant the space. So we are already seeing assets or buildings being defaulted on, the asset being foreclosed upon and going to the lender. So that distress is right here, right now, especially in commercial office across the U.S. Mm-hmm. and in Europe. In healthcare services, it's a little different. Healthcare services, what happened during COVID was that a lot of healthcare workers didn't want to go to work. There was a health hazard. And so nurses and doctors and other health professionals said, you know, if I'm going to go to work, I got to get paid a whole lot more. And then and that sticks. Generally speaking, wage increases are very sticky. It's very hard to unwind a wage increase. So that resulted in inflation, a step up in inflation in healthcare services because of labor. And then following COVID, with all the inflation that occurred in 2021, 2022, the cost of providing healthcare services, x-ray film, gauze, tapes, those all got more expensive too. And in the US and in much of the world, the payer base in healthcare is very consolidated. It's consolidated in the government and it's consolidated in insurance companies. And so when you have a consolidated payer base, but a very diffuse supplier base or service provider base, what happens is you get inflation on one side, but not enough coverage of that inflation on the other side. In other words, your payers are not willing to pay quite as much, even though you've had 15% inflation in your cost of goods sold or your labor. So the profitability of healthcare services companies has meaningfully declined. And prior to COVID, there were a fair number of healthcare services leveraged buyouts in the US and in Europe that took on a lot of debt at a time when debt was very cheap. And the expectation was that very stable performance would sort of come through and through on with that business. Maybe it's a radiology business or a dental business. And what happened was that inflation and didn't really, or isn't allowing for that to happen. So we are seeing stress that is, and in some cases, distress and defaults in the healthcare services space. I think there will be other industries too, but I think those two are the earliest that we're seeing problems.
And that deals with the sort of industries. Are there any geographies that you favor or you're seeking to avoid?
We're a global firm. We look at everything from in Australia, obviously, to Europe, Asia, and the U.S. I wouldn't say we're avoiding any particular geography, other than we are mindful of the various geopolitical issues around the globe, whether it's Israel, Palestine, or Ukraine and Russia. There are obviously knock-on effects in neighboring countries as a result of supply chain disruptions, refugees, etc. So we are mindful of that risk factor around geopolitical conditions. I wouldn't say that we have kind of a red line where we wouldn't invest in a particular region, other than obviously the regions and areas that are sanctioned by the U.S. Or there are sanctions against them as imposed by the U.S. So we obviously abide by international law, considering we are a U.S. based company, and we will avoid those countries and have always. But I wouldn't say there's any particular industry or region within the investable universe that we would draw a red line around and say it's not investable.
And you referred earlier in our conversation to the fact that you didn't need a really deep recession or severe economic dislocation to present the sort of opportunities that you're famous for in that opportunistic area. You refer to the fact that the market has tripled. What's driven and why, and what's that trend like, trajectory like in terms of that size of the market? What's driven it, and why is it three times the size, and is that likely to continue?
The three times or four times the size is really in comparison to the size of the market before the global financial crisis. So if you looked at, let's take, for example, private credit, direct lending. Direct lending prior to the global financial crisis was only a $250 billion market. Today, it's $1.5 trillion. So that's actually a huge increase. Broadly syndicated loans. So these are tradable loans, liquid loans. Sometimes they call them leveraged loans. A lot of that is owned by CLOs, collateralized loan obligations. These are levered vehicles where there are lenders into a vehicle. If you look at it, a CLO is just a balance sheet. On the asset side, it's just a bunch of loans, a very diversified pool of loans. On the liability side, it's a bunch of lenders who provide tranches of debt to the CLO to borrow. And there's been a lot of demand for those tranches of debt, and therefore a lot of CLO creation over the last 10 or 15 years. And so now broadly syndicated loans are a $1.4 trillion market in the US, which is roughly triple what it was in 2007. Now, the reason broadly syndicated loans and direct lending have moved up so large, it's largely because a lot of capital was raised in leverage buyouts. Private equity firms raised a tremendous amount of capital in the last 7 or 8 years, and they chose to finance themselves with floating rate liabilities, in other words, direct loans or broadly syndicated loans. And the main reason for that was because those two asset classes do not have the same degree of call protection or non-call protection that high yield bonds may have or investment grade bonds may have. So in an investment grade bond or a high yield bond, if you wanted to pay off your debt early because you sold your business, because you're an LBO sponsor and you sold your business after 2 years, you would have a big payment to make to your bondholders. That is not true in broadly syndicated loans or direct loans. You just pay it back apart. And so that's why it became the financing tool, the direct loans and broadly syndicated loans became the financing tools of choice for leverage buyouts. And as leverage buyout funds grew in number and in size following the global financial crisis, so did the financing markets that were attached to LBO deal activity. High yield bonds grew too, but I wouldn't say as much. They're probably two and a half times as large. And so not quite the same. It was just kind of a more natural growth in the borrowers themselves, rather than an exogenous or external factor that pushed, you know, high yield bond market larger.
And you referred to some of the distressed or opportunistic credit opportunities you look at where you buy investments at a deep discount to par, where the actual borrower may not survive, but you may be able to still make a return on your investment. Is that the type of opportunity you're looking at where you say, we might be the end owner of this and therefore we need expertise to actually operate the business rather than be a passive investor?
Absolutely. The advantage that we have as a firm is, you know, we have been in an opportunistic credit manager for many, many years, many decades, mm-hmm. Several cycles. We know what types of businesses, what types of industries we should be investing at different points in the cycle. We have management teams that we have put into place. We have management teams we know well. We have sector expertise within our teams. So we feel very well suited to manage businesses to the extent we had to own them. But specifically what I was referring to is, as these markets have grown, or the demand for broadly syndicated loans, for example, has grown, the quality of the legal protections in those documents over the last 10 or 15 years has actually deteriorated. Now, what that means is when a company is running out of money and it needs a capital solution, if its existing debt is quite flexible in terms of the lack of legal protections, what that allows for is a firm like Oaktree, an opportunistic credit lender, to come in and say, look, I could give you a really, really big loan. It's going to be a very tight legal document. But what I'm going to want is to attach collateral to my loan that the old loan had not touched. So, for example, let's say there's a loan that is secured by just the United States assets of a particular borrower, but 70% of this borrower's activities are actually outside the U.S. Well, we will have a loan that would actually attach collateral in the form of all of these non-U.S. subsidiaries. And we're not really stepping in front of the existing loan with respect to those, because, you know, that loan never had that pledge collateral. But we have a tighter legal document where we think even if this company were to default, our loan has so much collateral value supporting it that we could just get our money back and move on. Without owning that company. Now, if we are wrong about our underwriting and the coverage of our loan is not adequate, which would be surprising, but it's obviously possible, then yes, we are prepared to step in and actually own the business and restructure it and right size it in whatever ways need to be the case, and then, you know, monetize that investment at the right time in the future. We've done that a lot. We've been on boards, we've put in management teams, we know a lot of different industries, big and small. So we're very comfortable with it, but it's not our preferred path, frankly. Our preferred path is to, you know, just have a more consensual relationship with a borrower who needs a capital solution. And it works out well for them and it works out well for us because it buys them time and it buys the severity of the situation allows for us to charge an adequate rate of return and get legal protections that are superior to their existing loan documents.
And what do you find are the common misconceptions by investors who may not have had exposure to this asset class in the past or invested with someone like Oaktree? What are some of the common misconceptions that you're confronted with or sort of objections that you think really aren't the case?
Great question. I think the misconceptions are driven by a belief that distressed debt has or requires chopping up a company or becoming quite sideways or antagonistic with the management teams, and therefore the range of outcomes could be quite broad and potentially terrible. And that's just not really true. I think the way at least our experience at Oaktree has been in investing in distressed debt and actually restructuring businesses has been quite positive for management teams generally, unless the management team itself led the business into a default and must be replaced as a result of underperformance. That can happen. But it could also be the case, and it's frankly more frequently the case in our investments, that again, the business is actually a good business with a good management team, but with a balance sheet that was put in place at a time where the world was in a different place. And so what happens is, yes, there is a restructuring and the company gets delevered. The company, the debt on the business has to be forgiven, and the new ownership in the form of the old lenders needs to step in. So there is certainly a loss of value in, to the old ownership of the business. But in terms of the management teams themselves, they have an opportunity to now work at a company that has less debt and the ability to grow, and with an equity value where their options are struck at a lower value. And so they have a new lease on life. They have a new opportunity to actually earn equity value by performing well at that point forward. So we've had a very positive experience with the management teams. And we have found that we have been able to deliver equity-like results with less than equity-like risk, because a lot of our investments are targeting mid-teens returns, and we earn mid-teens and we get par back, and that's, we're happy to do that. So it's a more stable than expected asset class. So for example, the other thing I kind of related to this point is, you know, one would, I think, without knowing what distressed debt is or opportunistic credit is, you might say, wow, you probably have half of your investments go the wrong way, and then the other half, you know, work out. And, you know, I don't know, that's quite volatile and unpredictable. I mean, the word distressed debt, and maybe what you hear in the movies with, you know, people chop vulture capital or chopping up businesses, you know, might suggest that there's this, you know, there are half the deals go terribly wrong. You know, in our experience, for every loser we have something north of 30 winners. So from a, you know, from a batting average perspective, to use the sort of US baseball analogy, our batting average is incredibly strong. If you look at the billions and billions of dollars of deployment, very little of it is actually turned into losses, let alone realized losses. So we do a really good job of, even in our distressed debt business, of really taking on calculated risks where the risk of loss of capital is actually quite low. And to the extent that your listeners wanted to get information about Oaktree, I mean, they could reach out and we'd be happy to provide that that track record that shows that very, very high batting average in terms of loss avoidance versus winners in the portfolios.
And you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much for your input. Obviously, there's still a track record of Oaktree's there for all to see. Obviously, Howard's been prolific in his publication and his thoughts and his memos, and as have you've been also with the media and very generous with your time here. I will give you the opportunity to leave us with any last thought before we close out the podcast. So over to you if you've got any last area you think that listeners would benefit from hearing about.
Thank you, David. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to join you and your listeners. It's very exciting for us to speak with you, and I know that you have a following that's quite strong. I think my parting thoughts would be, right now, I've been surprised in the last few months with how resilient both the equity markets and the debt markets have been. I think we have, for the first time I could remember, the highest rates we have had in a long time and all-time highs on the equity markets. Those two kind of don't make sense. So someone's probably wrong. And it's concerning that that we're in this predicament. And so we ask ourselves at Oaktree, why could this be the case? And I think that the answer is the following. During COVID, there was a tremendous amount of stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, that was sprinkled across global economies, trillions and trillions of dollars. And that money made its way around the economy and eventually into the hands of savers, wealthy individuals, corporate pensions, insurance companies. And when you sit on trillions and trillions of dollars collectively, And you say, well, at some point, this whole thing's going to resolve and I can't sit on cash forever. I really do want to deploy capital into equities or debt. That capital will at some point rush off of the sidelines and into the field of investment and may inflate values beyond where the fundamentals would suggest are warranted. And I think that might be where we are to some extent right now. Obviously, it's not uniform. There are great businesses out there that actually benefited from COVID and benefited from inflation. So there certainly are winners through this all. But there are a material number of businesses globally that are not winners, that are at best indifferent and are actually losers against the backdrop of COVID or against inflation. And they took on debt and that at the wrong time. And I think with an elevated, if our earlier comments were correct, that there won't be a recession and rates do stay high, I think people will be surprised at the level of problems or defaults in the economy. And those won't really match up well with the fairly tight spreads in the credit markets and the ultra high valuations in the equity market. So, you know, I would just, I would caution folks a little bit because it felt to me that late last year and even the early part of this year, the markets rallied a little too far, too fast, and well in advance of the fundamentals. And, we're in an election year in the U.S. I think the Fed is willing to reduce rates very quickly if there's a recession. But I think without a recession, they're not going to want to really reduce rates because it's an election year. They don't want to be accused of manipulating the election. And so you have to kind of balance these and say, well, you know, what if there is a recession, how do I feel about my portfolio? Because that'll be a shock. Did I get too exposed to equities because I had this cash that was burning a hole in my pocket? Like, how will I feel about that? Or if the alternative, there's no recession and rates stay higher, how will I feel about my portfolio then? I would ask yourselves those two questions and make sure that your portfolio is crafted in a way where under both scenarios, you feel pretty good about the way you're allocated and positioned.
And they're very wise words to end the podcast on. Thank you very much for your time once again. Thanks for joining us at Inside the Rope.
Thank you very much, David. Good to chat with you.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Rope with David Clark. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can connect with David by visiting codacapital.com. Any views expressed in this recording represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or recommendation and may not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit www.moneysmart.gov.au to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.